We'll see how we do. This is my first sermon here at the Mission. That's lovely, that's great, thank you. But for those who don't know me or aren't here very regularly, I also lead at the front. One of the things I'm really worried about in this sermon is actually slipping into leading mode. So if halfway through I ask you to stand and sing, or if I kind of suddenly institute a time of open prayer, right, someone just raise a hand and wave, please. All right, that would be really helpful. Okay, this week we're looking at the next section in this powerful and significant conversation from John chapters 13 through to 17. Today's passage is John 15, 1 to 17, and you can find it on page 1022. So if you'd like to look that up right now, we're going to read it shortly. Now, I have really enjoyed this series so far. It's felt to me like a privileged insight into something incredibly intimate between Jesus and his disciples at this specific time. It feels a bit to me like Jesus's earnestness dial, if you like, is switched up to maximum in these chapters. Why do I think that? Well, Jesus is about to face the cross, the culmination of his mission, to die, taking the weight of all the wrong of mankind on his shoulders. And the whole point of that mission is about enabling a restored relationship between God and his people. Jesus has been offering this group, the disciples, that restored relationship in a unique way over his ministry over these last 3 years. Tom said to us last week, if you were here, he said the living God, the creator of the universe, has been present with them. He's walked with them, he's ate with them, he's taught with them, he's fished with them, etc., etc. I could go on. There was closeness, there was intimacy. It was ordained. He was doing this with them for a reason. But in order for that restored relationship to fully come to pass, we've also been seeing over these last few weeks that Jesus knew he had to go away. And they don't get that at all. And so within that tension that's created, Jesus is speaking very specific, deep things about the nature of who he is and what that means for their relationship with him. He's showing that, although he's going away for a time, as Tim mentioned in our first sermon, they cannot and they will not live without him, because they need to be washed by Jesus to be clean through what was done on the cross. And that through that, he's the way to the Father. They're going to need his peace in their hearts to manage their lives in this troubled world. So they're not going to be left as orphans. But Jesus promises to come back to them, to come back at the resurrection, and to leave us at Pentecost with his Holy Spirit, to come as the Holy Spirit for the rest of our earthly lives. But Jesus knows the difficult path that the disciples are going to take before they fully understand these truths. One of them, in this very moment, is betraying him to the authorities. All the others are going to desert him within a matter of hours. And into this space come the next words of Jesus. So we're going to read them now. Chapter 15, verses 1 to 17. I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, so that it will be even more fruitful. You are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain in me, and I will remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. If a man remains in me and I in him, he will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not remain in me, he is like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you remain in me, and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be given you. This is to my Father's glory, that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. If you obey my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have obeyed my Father's commands and remain in his love. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant doesn't know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you, and appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last. Then the Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. This is my command: love each other. Okay. This is an incredibly dense and rich passage, and we could easily occupy a whole series on looking at these verses, probably a whole series just on the first eight, and then another series on the remaining verses that we've just read. I've got about 15 to 20 minutes. I mean, I'm very happy to take a couple of hours if you're all willing, sitting comfortably, but probably 15 or 20 minutes, I'd imagine. So what I want to do in that time is I want to hone in on a central message. That's this: Jesus is the source of everything we need, so remain in him. That's what we're going to look at. And then a bit later, we're going to think about two questions: why remain in Jesus, and how do we remain in Jesus? And as we look at those, they're kind of going to overlap, but we'll sort of see if we can do it in two sections. Okay, so firstly, Jesus is the source of all that we need. Jesus always chooses the images he uses carefully. Here, it's the picture of a vine and its branches representing the vital connection between himself, a believer, God the Father, and the fruit that's produced. And significantly, though again we don't have time to go into this morning, it was Israel that was previously the vine that God tended. And it was given the responsibility of bringing about God's purposes in the world. But Israel failed. It rebelled. It became fruitless. A new vine was needed. And Jesus steps into that space, announcing now that he is the true vine, the authentic one, the permanent one, the vine that won't fail. And so as we get this imagery spreading out in the first eight verses, we see Jesus is the main stem of the vine, the channel through which all the resources pass that are needed for the branches to bear fruit. The believer is the branch, the end point of the system, if you like, the place where the fruit is produced. God the Father is the gardener, the one who tends to the branches, prunes them, cuts them, enables them to produce fruit. It's a pretty good image to talk about remaining in something, isn't it? Jesus chose well, funnily enough. So we're going to go all a little bit horticultural now. So maybe the green-fingered among you may be able to help me out. So, first question. Does anyone want to tell me if they know what country hosts the largest known vine in the world? That's the largest vine from a single stem. Anybody want to stab at an answer? Okay, thanks, Shee. No, not Italy. No, not Australia. Not Spain. France, Malaysia, the States. No. No. Sorry? Not Indonesia. No. Actually, you have to come a lot closer to home. In fact, if I orientate myself, about 40 miles that way. Okay? The largest vine from a single stem is at Hampton Court Palace. All right? Not Indonesia. Not India. All right? Is anybody interesting? Has anybody been to Hampton Court Palace? Clearly you've missed the vine if you have been there. And so nobody's seen the vine, I presume. Okay. How old do you think the vine is? How old's the vine? Does anyone have a stab a guess? 2 months old, yes. It's just a little wee one. Is that 60? A little bit less than 600 years. That would be very good going, but so, I know, 150 up, a bit higher. Oh, 450 down. Three, down. Come on, we'll get there. 240, that's right, well done. It's 240 years, so it was planted in 1716, all right? You can see it there. It's the edge of the greenhouse that's kind of holding up all the different branches. And then if we go to the next, we'll see this is the root. So at the back on the previous one, there's the viewing gallery. And then this is the stem of the vine that's sending out all the shoots over this whole greenhouse, which you can't see the back of in the previous one. It's huge. Last question. Does anybody think they can have a guess at who might have planted the vine in 1716? That sounds probably a really obscure question, but some of you will know who it is when you're told. Anyone? Sorry, I'm not hearing all the... No. It was planted by a chap called Capability Brown. Anyone heard of Capability Brown? Loads of gardens over England that he kind of orchestrated kind of in the mid-18th century, about 170 parks, and there's loads of them that still remain, all right? This is a description from the Hampton Court Palace website of the work that is needed through the year to enable this vine to bear fruit. Okay, I need a pause. Okay. In February, the buds begin to break. A fertilizer is then applied to the soil inside the glasshouse and the vine border outside. Once the new shoots are 2.5 to 5 centimeters long, it's then time for disbudding, of course, to reduce the number of new shoots. The remaining shoots grow to 30 to 45 centimeters long. They then have their growing point pinched and are tied in with raffia. The vine is protected against mildew with vaporizing sulfur, of all things. Immediately after flowering, the number of bunches are reduced and the remaining bunches are thinned. During the growing season, the vine is given liquid and special foliar feeds, what they are. Later in the summer, some leaf thinning is carried out to allow sunlight to fall on the ripening fruit. In November and December, when the plant is fully dormant, the fruiting spurs are pruned back to one or two buds. Every year. But all of that tending produces up to 400 kilograms of grapes every crop. 400 kilograms. Does that sound like easy work to you? It doesn't to me. I imagine that it's not just this lady here. I imagine that there are a whole team of people who are employed to tend the vine at Hampton Court Palace. But in the spiritual context, here in the passage, God's tending and pruning us is really needed work, isn't it? Vine branches clearly are not easy to tend. In fact, actually, they're notorious for it. That's why they need all this work. They won't produce good fruit if they're left wild to do their own thing. Indeed, wild, untended grapes are normally extremely bitter. No, they need intensive ministering to enable the production of usable fruit. Sound familiar? It's the same for us. And this can be a painful process, but it's always fruitful, both for ourselves and for others around us. It's going to be hard to grow as Christians and bear fruit if we don't let God do this work in us. There's such a need in this world, too, for the fruit that we can produce. And as we're pruned, we're changed. Do we long for that? Do I long for that enough? Do you feel a need to be tended in that way? I know I do. And we need to put ourselves in a position to be tended by God by remaining in Jesus. Importantly, too, here, in verse 3, we're already clean if we've come to Jesus. It's not about salvation. This is about our onward growth. So the work of Jesus on the cross connects us with the Father so that he can tend us. Two further points in this section, slightly shorter points. Verse 15, we're told that we have available the same teaching through Jesus that God made available to him. I'll say that again. We have available the same teaching through Jesus that God made available to him. Now that's incredible. That's a resource. And again, it shows the intimacy. How close is the Father-Son relationship? Well, this is what we're told, that we're getting the resource that's like that. It's not like we're servants who don't get to know the inner secrets of the household, verse 15. We're friends. We're included. We're involved. We're in the know. I think if we really knew this, then we'd seek it. And this seeking is a key way, again, that we can remain in him. Thirdly, we're told in verse 7 that by remaining in him, whatever we ask for will be given to us. Now, is that an open invitation to ask for whatever we want? Well, on one level, that's true. But if we look at verse 8, it's talking about relating what we're asking for to the fruit that we're going to be bringing about. How often are our prayers or our time thinking about that, asking for those things that will bring about the fruit in us? And again, when we do this, that's another way that we're remaining in him. So, we've looked at some of what it means to have Jesus as the source of everything we need. We're going to turn to our two questions now about remaining in him. So the first one was this: why remain in Jesus? The first answer to this is to be fruitful. It can be found in verse 4. It's our purpose as his children to bear fruit, and we can't do it by ourselves. We've got to reside in him in order to do it. Verse 5 says, without him, we can do nothing. So we should care about our ability to bear fruit. It's a sign of our relationship with Jesus. So we should always be reviewing which area of our lives might need pruning. Something practical here is looking at the fruit of the Spirit, going through love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control. Where am I lacking in those areas? Where do I need to make up, to look at being more fruitful in those areas? How is that applying in my life? What areas do I need to apply those in? Secondly, though not easily, the second point is about avoiding judgment. Verse 6. I'll read verse 6 again. If anyone does not remain in me, he's like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire, and burned. Now, clearly this is not an easy area, and there's not time in this sermon or the focus in this sermon to go into that fully. But again, if we're looking at the imagery, there's something clear and strong here. The imagery shows us that there's clearly got to be a flow from the stem to the branches. And it's in many ways a two-way process, a drawing on him and being resourced by him. And unlike the branches of a real vine, we actually do have a choice about whether we remain or not. Our choices do make a difference according to this verse. We perhaps need to look no further than the context of where Judas's decisions have taken him. right in the passage. It's important that we know that our hearts are such that it is easy for us to be diverted by desires that are not based on knowing Jesus, but on our own wills and on our sinful nature. If we are not careful and intentional about where we place our desires, our longings, the actions that come from them, consistently over time, that we don't check them against God's standards, then it is possible our spiritual perspective can change. It can change from the image we looked at earlier with the vine, the true vine, to something like this, to separate individual vines, where we've put our trust in other things, where we've believed in different things, that our branch, if you like, has been grafted onto another vine. Now, perhaps unusually, that the imagery of a toaster might help us here. I'm sure that you were all probably there with me on that one. You probably imagined that was coming next. Put your hands up here if you've got a toaster in your kitchen. Right, keep your hands up. Right, keep your hands up if your toaster works. Excellent. Was there anybody that put their hand down just then? Nobody put their hand down then. That's fantastic. That is because it's a very easily identifiable item that we can say, that has become useless. If a toaster stops being able to produce toast, other than perhaps for a fuse going in the plug, then we really know that there's only one thing that we can do with it. It's just fit for the bin. So indulge me a moment as I go further into this. Imagine someone who valued toast more above more than anything else in the world. It'd be hard to imagine, but I want you to try. The toaster clearly would have pride of place in the kitchen, or even it might have a room of its own, maybe. The toastery, I've invented a whole new room, maybe. The act of heating bread up to convert it to its best state would be an art form. I picture lots of separate gadgets in the kitchen around the toasters. The toaster would have a weekly service. It would have a wax. It would have a polish. The merest hint that there ever might be a fault in the toaster would cause an engineer to be round in hours, because clearly there would be an insurance policy on this toaster, wouldn't there? Okay, now we laugh. What would it look like to have the same attitude towards our branches that are meant to produce fruit by remaining in Jesus? What would it be like to give that the same attention? I know that I seriously need to look at how I'm doing with that. Okay, well, that leads us into our last section, which is thinking about how we can remain in him. There's three areas that we're going to look at to finish. The first is this, obeying his commands, which is found in verse 10. I wonder, do we make the connection between our moral conduct, obeying Jesus' commands, and remaining in him? This was something that I thought about quite a lot as I was putting this together. And I actually think it's something that's really easy to miss in our day-to-day living. I think it's easy to put obeying those commands on one side and then our time being with Jesus, approaching Jesus, speaking to him on another, and not really see the link. But this passage is speaking something differently into this. And I think actually turning it on its head is actually a way of helping us to perhaps understand what it's saying. If we do that, then it says this. It says, remaining in Jesus' love will involve obeying his commands. Now, somehow when it's put that way around, that seems harder to separate the two when we think of it like that. And you can take any example of Jesus' words. You could take our money, our sexual conduct. You could take all manner of things as examples. But choosing not to obey Jesus' commands in any of these areas is likely to mean that we've not understood how to remain in him in that area of our lives. Now, of course, that is not to deny grace and forgiveness for the times when we mess up. Of course not. But there is something in grace that implies we are willing to return to him over that and seek him. And at the top of these commands, Jesus places, verse 12, loving each other, which is the second point. This is singled out as a really important thing. And we shouldn't be surprised by that. When Jesus was asked to give the greatest commandment, he said that it was to love the Lord your God with all your soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. So making the connection again, loving one another is a key way that we can remain in him. I think the reason this gets high priority here is that loving others and fruit are really closely connected. Just back in John 13, Jesus has said, "All men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another." So this means that as we're actively actioning ways to love our family, our friends, our neighbours more, we're more deeply remaining in Jesus as we do. And love leads us on to our final point in how to remain and the closing point in this sermon. Jesus said in verse 13, "Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends." Why is this verse here? Again, it seems a little bit to sort of come out of the blue. What purpose is it serving? I think that it's here to remind us that it's only because Jesus has fully obeyed the Father in his willingness to go to the cross that we are able to remain in him at all. We cannot obey enough or love enough that we are accepted into God's love on the basis of those things. That is not the gospel. So the last how to remain is about relying on what Jesus has done. That's our foundation. That's our starting point when all other things feel impossible. When we feel too broken, we feel too weak to be able to live them out. We must first recognize that actually it was first all done for us, and we can't get there with our own achievements. And our changeable, fickle, legalistic hearts will often want to do it another way. They're going to want to try and remain in him through our own strength and actions. And that is often because pride prevents us from wanting to accept this freely, like we must earn it in some way. We just want to be independent, and we feel that's a good thing. But again, this is not the gospel. The gospel is about dependence. It's about saying, "I can't, but you can." And our egos, our controlling selves, do not like that. But perhaps, if we see that we have been chosen, we've been called friends, we've been loved unconditionally, we've been taught, we've been tended, we've been offered a remain in me embrace forever by the one who flung the stars into space, created all that we can see, and gave himself up for us. Perhaps our hearts will let go more into remaining in Jesus, who's the source of everything that we need.